the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Most of what we talk about on this program is retirement. But when you think of retirement, you're probably thinking, age 65, 66, maybe later. What about the possibility if you could retire earlier and retire on your own terms? That is the subject of today's interview. Joining me on the program is Tanya Hester. She's written a book called Work Optional, Retire Early, The Non-Penny Pinching Way. Tanya, I wonder, as we kind of set the stage here, if you would kind of describe your lifestyle, living sort of a hectic lifestyle. You were an overachiever in high school, college, and in your career, and then making all of a sudden a transition to retirement at the age of 38.
Yeah, my husband Mark and I both had successful careers as consultants in the political and social cause space. And we really loved a lot about what we did, but it was definitely a grind. We regularly worked 60-hour weeks, 80-hour weeks were not unheard of. I was traveling more than 100 flights a year and staying in hotels in what felt like more nights than I was home. And, you know, it really took a toll on our stress level, on our health, on our relationship. And I think there was a point mid-career when we realized, you know, we can keep doing this forever, or we can put ourselves on a different path, even though I especially have always been a high achiever, as you said. Mark would describe himself more as like a B-plus student, which I think he doesn't give himself enough credit, but he isn't as naturally kind of ambitious. So he, I think, had an easier time transitioning into early retirement. But yeah, now we live a totally different kind of life. Although I will say I still do a lot of stuff that looks like work, but it's sort of those passion projects that we would all choose to do for free. I think of it as what you would have done without anybody offering you money, like in high school. If you would have said yes to it then it's great work to do in early retirement because you don't have to do it. You can leave it alone and go ski one day if you feel like it.
Tanya, was this something that you and Mark both came to a mutual agreement at the same time, or was it something you worked on him, he worked on you? How did this take place?
I've definitely heard from other couples that it took one partner working on the other for a while to get there. So I think that's pretty common. But no, for us, it was pretty much instant agreement. I think once we both understood what was possible, you know, we didn't need any convincing. It was like, yes, let's do this.
Now, you started this book and you divided it into three sections. Let's talk about the way you put this book together. One, the first section is envisioning a life that you want to live. Second, the financial planning portion, how are you going to get there? And number three, post-work life, financially, what does that look like? So describe your format and the way you put this together, because you really are trying to convince people this is really possible.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, a big motivator through this whole journey of saving for early retirement was picturing the life that we wanted to live. And that's significant because I was never naturally frugal. I was not a good saver. I made a ton of financial mistakes early in my working career. And it was really only once I got a sense of why I wanted to do all of this, that suddenly I felt this new level of motivation to save money. And so I do think that there's something really motivating about thinking about your life first and thinking about not just what is it you're looking to escape. Because of course, we all have bad days at work and we think, oh gosh, I would just love to burn this place down and never look back. But that's not how you plan the next chapter of your life. You plan the next chapter by thinking about what is it that I want to do? What do I want my day-to-day life to look like? What do I want to be contributing to society? How will I derive meaning and identity and purpose without a conventional career title? Those are things that require some thought. So I walk readers through that so that you can get that full vision. And then that, I think, helps motivate the financial piece. It's a lot easier to say, okay, well, do I really need to buy takeout three times a week if I could get myself instead closer to this ideal life? That makes the financial decisions easier, having the life vision in your mind. So those are the two pieces I think that are really important, and that's why I put them in that order. And then the third piece of making the leap, I think a lot of folks make the mistake, whether it's talking about early retirement or traditional retirement. I dug deep on the research for this, but a lot of folks really underestimate how big a deal that transition is. And so I wanted to help people make the transition as successfully as possible and to think about all the aspects of it, from how much notice to give at work to how you're going to get enough social interaction when you no longer go to work every day.
You know, the interesting thing about this, even if you think of retirement in the traditional way where people used to retire at age 65 or 66, you're seeing, you highlight this in your book, that even in the age 65 to 74 age group, you're seeing an increasing amount of individuals who are entering back into the labor force, whether it's either full-time in a different job or even part-time. You talk about it increasing to nearly 32% by the year 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to move on to, in your book, you talk about the sociologist Robert Weiss, and he defines retirement in three different ways, and I'd like to talk about them. One, economically, by the fact you don't need to work for money. Number two, psychologically, by your own determination that you feel retired. And three, sociologically, according to whether society sees you as retired. If you put yourself in a position to walk away from work, whether that's forever, temporary, or partially, you can call yourself retired, I guess, in some form. So let's talk about those three categories.
Yeah, and I think I owe such a debt of gratitude to Robert S. Weiss for his research, because it's really, you see it throughout the book. It was so helpful, and he did a really thorough look at the transition into retirement that I'm very grateful. The three definitions that he creates, I think, make intuitive sense, but I think most folks understand that we tend to apply the third one, the sociological definition, a bit too much. Does society see you as retired? I think this is less of an issue for traditional retirees. You know, if someone is 70 and does a part-time job, people don't quibble with them about whether they're retired. But we find that there's an interesting double standard with early retirement, where someone will say, well, you're sitting at your computer and typing something, so that looks like work, so you must not be retired. It's an odd thing. And I really broke that down for readers and brought in Weiss's definitions, because I really want to urge people to create their own definition. I think retirement does come with baggage. It comes with this image of either sitting in a rocking chair or sitting on the beach or playing golf. And it's as though those are the only three things you're allowed to do, which we all know is so foolish. But I want people to think about not retirement, if that word hangs you up, but what would your life look like if you could make work optional? It's fine if it still includes some work, or if it includes work sometimes, if that's what it takes for you to get there financially, or if you just like work and you still want to do some, that's great. And if you still also want to call yourself retired, I think you're allowed to. It's if the first two, financially, if you're ready and psychologically you feel retired, then in my book, you're retired.
You know, it's rather interesting, because I want to move on to another category you talk about when you're defining retirement. Full early retirement, which is what you did. Semi-retirement, where maybe you work part-time. In three, career intermission, where you take a break from work. And it's interesting, Tanya, because last week I interviewed a high-tech entrepreneur who was working in Silicon Valley, putting in crazy hours inventing stuff for major computers. And his health started to deteriorate at an early age, got diabetes, high blood pressure. He took a year off from work, lost 70 pounds, got into health, and came back and figured, you know, I don't want to work that way, and started a company and invented a digital gym. So he took an intermission, but then came back and redid his life.
I love that story. That's amazing. And I think that is a perfect use of that. And the only reason he was able to do that is because he clearly made some good financial decisions that he could take a year and step back. And I do think that that's really true, that being able to step back from your work or your career for a while, whether it's to do some personal discovery or to get healthy or to go on a big trip you've always dreamed of doing or to be able to stay home and take care of a loved one, whatever the reasons are, I think that, like you said, it can be a really powerful tool to kind of reevaluate your whole life. So that's amazing.
Yeah, I want to move on to something that you spent some time in your book, and I think this is really important, and that is to define your work optional life. In other words, if you were to retire or semi-retire, what your day-to-day life would be like. And you have things like, when are you happiest? What do you want to make time for every day? What are your favorite hobbies? In other words, if you had all this time, what would you do with it? How would you fill your day?
Yeah, you know, we tend as a society to really value work and the contribution through employment above everything. And we're not asked very much growing up or in school or in work after that, you know, sort of like, who are you outside of work? You know, the first question someone will generally ask when you meet them is, what do you do? And so a lot of us, I think, tend to think of our life outside of work or our life beyond work in slightly vague terms or amorphous terms. And I wanted to help people break something very big and amorphous down into really practical answers so that you could actually envision what a day would truly look like. So yeah, you listed some of those questions. It's also, who else is part of that life vision? What do you want your legacy to be when you're gone? What are some local challenges that you see and you'd like to be involved in fixing? It can be all of those different things, but it's sort of like if you ask a six-year-old, what do you want to be when you grow up? It's like some people will have a ready answer, but for a lot of us, that's a big, scary question. And so I tried to take that big, scary question of what do I want to be when I grow up and make it much more approachable.
Now, let's move on to some of the financial aspects because, you know, when most people think about retirement, they think of how much I put aside, how much I've saved, what will my pension, Social Security be. You talk about defining a money mission statement, and in it, you also highlight questions. Ask yourself how you spend money, which are very important because when you're talking about retirement, you're talking about, you know, it takes money to retire. You're going to spend money. The question is, how do you spend your money?
Yeah, I think the money mission statement in my life was really transformative and helped me change some of my worst financial habits. And so I really wanted to share that with readers. Of the example that I use in the book is, if you ask a vegetarian, do you want a hamburger? They don't have to stop and think about it. They just say, no, I don't do that. And there's no willpower required in that transaction. It's just an easy answer. So I think of a money mission statement as similar. So the example I use for myself in the book is that I realized that going to the store Target was a big spending trigger for me and that I'd go in looking for three things and I'd leave with a shopping cart full. I think a lot of people can relate to that experience. And I finally realized, like, I just can't go to Target. There's no way that I can go in there and control myself. So I just have to find ways that are different to get the things that I used to buy there. And it's fine. I don't miss it. Life without Target goes on. And it's creating things like that just so you sort of know, what is it that I want my money to do? What are the things that cause me to make bad choices with my money that I later regret? And how does that tie into sort of my bigger life vision?
Yeah, with me, it's Costco, but at least I get free... But at least I get free food samples. So,
yeah, you're not alone. I hear that from a lot of readers. We don't belong to Costco for exactly that reason.
Well, let's talk about investing funds. In your chapter, you talk about drawdown investing where, you know, for example, some people might take a withdrawal rate of funds or ETFs they own, dividend investing, which is one of my favorites, rental real estate, passive income generation. Things that are going to generate income in one form or another. Let's move on to that.
Sure. So with early retirement, which is really any retirement before you're eligible to either tap 401k or IRA funds or before you're eligible to take Social Security, you need other sources of income that can sustain you. And so I give folks the range of options. I'm not interested in telling people what their investment plan should be because I think that's a really individual decision that is based on your risk tolerance and just what sounds interesting to you. Some people love the idea of building a small empire of rental homes that they get to manage. Some people really love that. They love dealing with people and doing all those things. For me, that would stress me out like crazy. I don't want all those mortgages. And so for us, we focus primarily on index fund investing, which is really just trying to go for the lowest fee to returns ratio possible. So I lay all that stuff out, but really in a way that lets you make your own choice. And if you want to build a multifaceted, super complicated financial plan, because you just geek out on that stuff, you're absolutely able to. And if you want to keep it really simple and just stick with one thing, I talk about how to do that too.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
I want to move on to shelter and healthcare, and I want to just kind of relate a story because you touch upon this in your book. I had a couple. He was a private home builder. They sold their house, sold it to their kids, bought an RV, and spent 5 years going across the country. And the reason they did that, Tanya, they looked at what friends of theirs were doing, how much they would, you know, spend to go, let's say, a trip to Europe for a couple of weeks at $20,000 or to Asia. And they took a look at living in a RV and traveling across the country was so much more economical and made it work. And they said it was the best 5 years they ever spent of their life.
I believe that. And I think that if you want to do something like that, that's terrific. What I talk about in the book is making sure that you have a plan for different phases of your life. So if you want to spend, let's say, the first 5 years or 10 years even of traditional retirement doing something non-conventional like that, like traveling in an RV, or we have some friends who are full-time travelers who just stay in hotels and Airbnbs and occasionally rent apartments short-term, but that's their whole life. They have no permanent home base. I think that's great while you're healthy and able-bodied and able to do all of that stuff. But I talk about making sure that you also have some contingencies built in and a backup plan so that if, for example, you're less mobile or you become disabled or sick and you need in-home care, that you have a housing situation where you can accommodate that. Because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about what Medicare covers, but it covers almost no nursing home care. So the idea of just going into a rehabilitation facility or nursing home when you need that treatment and assuming Medicare will cover it, that's not going to work for most people. But if you can get care to come into your home, then they actually will cover that at a pretty decent rate. Of course, all of this could change. And so depending how far out you are from Medicare eligibility, this may or may not apply, but just giving yourself options so that if you do the RV life for 5 years and you say, okay, now we're bored of that and we'd really like to have a proper home, that you have the ability to do that, that you have enough flexibility in there to change plans.
And let's talk about setting up a secure source of income, whether it's annuities, a safe withdrawal rate from, let's say, index funds, or doing things like Roth conversions where you get tax-free income. Or Tanya, what about, let's say, moving to another state? Let's say you live in California where the cost of living and taxes are high. In order to do what you want to do, you go someplace else where there's no taxes and the cost of living is cheaper.
That is an interesting question, and I think it's really worth it to run the numbers so that you actually know what you're looking at. Because we live in California, and we decided to stay here very deliberately. We live near Lake Tahoe, where we wouldn't have to go far to be in Nevada, which everyone is quick to remind us has no state income tax. But it's worth looking at your own situation, because particularly for early retirees who tend to be on the frugal end of things, your actual taxable income in retirement is likely to be fairly low. And so in California, for example, our state income tax is really progressive, which means that it's a low rate for lower incomes and then it becomes a higher rate as your income goes up. So for folks who have a lower taxable income, because a lot of what we're taking out of index funds is just cost basis. In other words, the money we spent to buy the shares in the first place, which so that doesn't count as income. So our state income tax liability is very, very low. Our federal tax liability is very low. And in California, property taxes are capped at 1% a year by law. So our property tax is essentially going up slower than inflation, which means it'll get relatively smaller over time. So in our case, it actually gets cheaper each year we stay in California in a weird way. But that's not going to be true for everyone. So I think we do know others who moved from, for example, the San Francisco Bay Area to Oregon or moved to Utah. We know people who've moved to the Midwest. So there are tons of options. I think it's just important to look at all of it, including what the healthcare landscape is in each state, because that can vary really dramatically. And a lot of the states that tend to be cited as the best places to retire actually have poor healthcare access. So I just urge folks to look at your own numbers, really do the math on it, and to look at the overall landscape.
I want to move on to a topic that impacts a lot of individuals, and especially retirees, but more so if you retire early, and that is inflation. Let's talk about that next, because like in your case, where you retired at age 38, your life expectancy is 45, 50 years or longer. you know, over 45, 50 years, your cost of living is going to be going up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's always really, really important to account for that. I encourage readers in the book to forecast very conservative real gains, in other words, gains after inflation, when making your financial plan so that you're not reliant on gains in line with, say, the last decade when we've had a historically long bull market, that you're looking at growth that's much more slow and steady, if you will. I think there are some other things you can do, though, to control your costs, like, for example, owning your home and paying off your mortgage before you retire. If you're able to do something like that, then you can always live much more cheaply if you have to. And that's something that we did in our particular case. But I think the best guard against inflation, honestly, is just being really intentional about your spending, knowing where all your money's going so that you know where you can trim back if you had to. And always just keeping your financial planning very conservative. So you're not, for example, using too high a safe withdrawal rate that is going to put you at risk of running out of money too soon.
I want to stay on that topic for a minute. You mentioned earlier, you early on discovered going to Target was not a good decision for you. And we live in a society where I don't care if you even go to the movies, turn on a television set, pick up a newspaper, magazine, we are bombarded with incentives to spend. And how did you transition from that? In other words, if you loved going on Target and binging, how did you kind of, did you go through withdrawals? In other words, when you say, you know what, I really don't need that. Was it a major hard shift to go through that?
You know, it wasn't, but I think it's because of how we did it. We really tried to automate as much of our decision making as possible. In other words, we called it hiding money from ourselves. So we had our paycheck split so that most of our money was going into savings and we just lived on what was left over in checking. So it didn't feel like we were having to constantly transfer money and make ourselves aware of what we weren't able to buy with this money we were transferring. We just tried to let the savings happen in the background. And then, you know, sure, I would drive by Target sometimes and say, it would be nice to go in there. But it really wasn't hard because we did focus on what we were saving for. And we tracked everything really meticulously each month so that we could see that number going up. And I will just say, when you see your numbers going in a positive direction, it's really motivating. It's the same as when people are trying to lose weight. If you keep track of it, you're much more likely to stick to it because you're holding yourself accountable. With saving money, by watching that line go up, I really didn't want to do the stuff that would make it go in the wrong direction. So it was kind of just giving myself a different incentive. And I think Mark felt the same. And we also didn't sacrifice the stuff that we truly loved. We focused on cutting the things out of our spending that didn't actually add value to our lives. But things like travel, we still absolutely spent money on. So it wasn't about going from freewheeling to spending nothing. It was about cutting out the no value spending, which we ultimately found we just didn't really miss that much.
I want to move on to sort of a what I would call a transitional phase, and that is what you describe as a career intermission, just like the gentleman I told you that took a year off from work and then started a company, and then also possibly for, let's say, retraining for a second career. I had a neurologist that we planned to retire at a certain age, but he felt like he wasn't ready to retire. So he ended up working with a chiropractic firm and he worked part-time, but that part-time enabled him to go with his sport car club and enabled him with his photography hobby and enabled him to travel and basically pay for trips. But he sort of planned a second career, maybe not as rigorous and full-time, but let's talk about that transitional phase or what you call maybe an intermission.
Yeah, the main thing was I really wanted to make early retirement something that was accessible to as many people as possible. So we've got a country in which we know from data that people who earn minimum wage can't afford to rent an apartment in any US city. So I think if you're in that situation, I'd really urge you to look at ways that you might be able to retrain for a different career. But I think for almost everyone, if you're able to save a little bit of money, even if something like full early retirement, particularly in your 30s or 40s, feels like, whoa, that's just crazy. That's never happening. I wanted to still give people options. And so the two I talk about in the book are semi-retirement, which is being able to cut back or work seasonally or, you know, just work some of the time. And career intermission is exactly that, what you've been talking about, taking a year off or maybe even scheduling it. So you take a year off every 5 years or every 10 years. Kind of thinking of it as like a self-funded sabbatical. But I think that it can be just a really nice way to give yourself options in life, even if walking away from work forever isn't on the table for you. And as we kind of talked about earlier, it could be for any number of reasons, but it's sort of giving yourself that chance to step back from work and hit reset and to catch up on sleep and spend time with those you care about. I just think it can be incredibly powerful.
We always encourage people, whether they're going to do like you did, take an early retirement, an intermission, or even work semi-retired, you need to have a plan. And the thing that people really need to know is a budget. And you have a formula for fast savings progress. I wonder if you'd share it with our listeners.
Yeah. So I know that a lot of the information in the book can feel a little bit dense. And I wanted to help folks really boil it down to, if you don't feel like you can make a bunch of changes in your life, if you can do four things, you can still save money quickly. And so the first is underspend on housing. Second is underspend on transportation, which means really just not getting a new car every few years or taking public transit if you can. Three is focus on increasing your earnings, maybe retraining for a new career, maybe taking on a side hustle, maybe working harder in your current job. And four, which I think is so, so powerful, is to bank your raises. If you do nothing else but keep your spending level over time and focus on increasing your income, it is amazing how much you can save. It really skyrockets every single year.
And finally, let's get to the point. You've gone through some self-evaluation. You think, you know what? There's other things I'd like to do. I would like to retire early. Let's talk about getting yourself emotionally ready. You have a chapter called Making the Big Leap and Pulling the Ripcord. Take our listeners, if you would, some of the things that you really want to think through before you jump, not just the idea, oh gosh, I'm stressed out, I hate the commute, I'm tired of living out of hotels, I need to retire or semi-retire, without really thinking through all the things that you're going to be facing.
The list of things that you want to think about at that point, at the moment of transition, is fairly long. And so this chapter does have a large number of checklists in it. And some of the things are really practical, like making sure that you'll have health insurance, whether that's getting COBRA through your former employer or maybe buying an exchange plan through the healthcare.gov federal exchange or your state exchange if you have one. But it's also some of the psychological questions. Like, we know, to bring back Robert S. Weiss's research, we know from his research that retirees who celebrate the transition and who really mark it as a life moment end up happier in retirement than those who don't, than those who just kind of disappear quietly from the workplace and don't celebrate the moment. Unfortunately, a lot of folks don't get to make that choice. And we know that about 2/3 of people actually are forced to retire earlier than they intend to and may not properly celebrate for a variety of reasons. They might get laid off, they might have to leave because they're ill, or they have to care for a loved one. But to the extent you can, if you can celebrate that transition, we know that that is associated with more positive outcomes. It's also good to just think about, like, how much notice you want to give. I generally think 8 weeks or less tends to be pretty good so that you don't sit around feeling like a lame duck for too long. And then thinking about the emotional side of the transition, kind of creating some new rituals for yourself is a really nice thing. So for us, we stopped setting alarm clocks, and I will say that never gets old. It is marvelous waking up without one. We did a little celebratory thing and decided to just jump on the bed one day, and I dyed my hair purple. It's kind of a symbol of I'm not, you know, in a corporate job anymore. And so if there's something fun like that seems like the thing to you to do, of what have you always wanted to do but you couldn't because of your job, maybe this is the time to do it, to help kind of set that tone for yourself. Like, I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I go, oh, I have purple hair. it's a reminder, as if I needed one, that life is different now. And it gives me that moment of, wow, I'm so lucky. This is so wonderful.
Tanya, during the course of your retirement, did you end up doing things, either a hobby or get involved in something differently than what you thought would be the case when you first retired?
I will say the thing that has been the most surprising is how much time I spend doing stuff that looks like work. I spent all these years dreaming about not having to work anymore, but you started out this conversation talking about how I was an overachiever. And looking back, I think it was a little bit naive to think that I wouldn't continue to be one in some way. You know, it's like we are who we are. And if you're someone who is a doer and always has ideas for things you want to try, that's still going to be true after you quit working. And so for me, the real gift is that everything I work on is something for myself. So I write a blog, I have a podcast, I wrote the book. Nobody made me do any of those things. No one said, you have to do this by X date. I didn't feel like there was any financial incentive to do any of them. It was just because everything sounded fun and fulfilled something within me. But yeah, I would say that's the biggest surprise, is that we live in the mountains to be able to get outside, and we do that plenty, but I'm also inside at my computer a lot, and it's surprising how good that feels.
Did you find yourself with the urge to travel more? In other words, with no clocks, no time schedules, not having to be at work, wanting to just kind of take off and just run and go and see places you might have not had the chance to do when you were working?
Travel was always a huge part of our motivation to retire early, and we definitely have been doing that a lot. So in our first year, we went to Taiwan, Mexico, France, and Monaco, and a bunch of different places around the US. So we were gone about a quarter of the year, which was, we think, about the right mix for us, at least for now. So we're thinking of our early retirement in kind of 5-year chunks. So for the first 5 years, we think gone about a quarter of the time makes sense. And then beyond that, we'll kind of reevaluate. But yes, we got to travel a bunch, which I think raises a really important point that there is a lot of conventional wisdom out there for traditional retirement, but I think it applies as well to early retirement, that folks are often told you will spend 70 to 80% in retirement of what you spent while working. And some of that is logical. You won't have commute costs anymore. You won't have to pay for all that dry cleaning for your work clothes if your job required that, some things like that. But I think this idea that you're naturally going to spend less is a little bit crazy, because there are so many things you can do all of a sudden, and most of those things aren't free. Travel certainly isn't free. Different hobbies aren't free. You have more time to go to concerts or, you know, to do whatever you're into, and most of that stuff costs money. So that's another reason why I really urge people to think about in detail, what do you want this life to look like that you're aiming for, so that you can figure out how much it costs? Because I just don't think that conventional wisdom is true. I think that's more chicken or egg of most people spend less in retirement because they have less to spend, not because they ideally would choose to spend less.
I couldn't agree with you more. Well, listen, Tanya, this was a fabulous, fabulous book. And if you're out there listening and you're thinking, well, I'm going to have to work to 65, 66, I really don't want to, I advise you to pick up this copy. You may get some good ideas, and who knows, you could end up just like Tanya, retiring much earlier. Tanya, thanks for joining us on the program. The name of the book is called Work Optional, Retire Early in the Non-Penny-Pinching Way by Tanya Hester, who's been my guest. Tanya, all the best to you. Great book.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to speak.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.